It's hard to imagine now, but there was a time when videos of violent police encounters were not regularly showing up on the news or in our social media feeds. So think about what it might have been like back in 1991 when a bystander in Los Angeles picked up a camcorder and taped this. A group of Los Angeles police officers surrounding an unarmed black man, kicking and hitting him with their batons over and over again. The beating of Rodney King was shocking, and it kept being replayed on national TV. Many people saw it as a symbol of police brutality and racial injustice. But a jury didn't see it that way. On April 29, 1992, the four LAPD officers charged with beating Rodney King were acquitted. Hours later, outrage over the verdict spilled into the streets of Los Angeles. The LA riots lasted 5 days and changed the city forever. I'm Kelly McEvers with All Things Considered, and this is a look at the legacy of the LA riots 25 years later. We're taking on some big questions, things that continue to inform our reporting even today. Like, how has the LAPD changed? How did the city rebuild after the riots? We'll also hear some overlooked stories, like what happened to a predominantly Latino neighborhood during the riots. And a personal story about how Nirvana, yes, the 90s grunge band, put one South Central looter on a different path in life. But first, the police response to the riots, or lack of response, and how that eventually led to changes at the LAPD. I met up with Karen Grigsby Bates from our Code Switch team at the corner of Florence and Normandy in LA. That's where the riots began. And she says when the Rodney King verdict came down, Black LA was furious.
People got angrier and angrier. More and more people came out into the street, and eventually some young guys broke into a bunch of the liquor stores that are in this neighborhood, including this one that we're leaning up against.
Yeah.
And things escalated quickly from there. They started throwing cans and bottles. Some pulled panic-passing drivers out of their cars and assaulted them.
One of the issues was that the police didn't respond in force, especially at the beginning. You actually talked to somebody who was there at the time. He's a reporter named Joe Dominic. Let's take a listen to that.
One of the most astounding things about the 1992 Los Angeles riots was the response of the LAPD, which is to say, no response at all.
Part of the reason there wasn't a response was because there wasn't a plan. Police brass, divorced from what was happening at street level, didn't anticipate social unrest on a major scale. No orders were coming from police headquarters at Parker Center to tell cops what to do. It was a mistake that led to the riots spreading well beyond Florence and Normandy.
They were watching it all, but they were not stopping it.
Joe Dominic says that's how the LAPD worked back then. It was a legacy of Chief William Parker, who ran the department from 1950 to 1966. Parker created the modern paramilitary LAPD you often see on TV shows. In 1992, his protege, Darryl Gates, was in charge. Like Parker, Gates was an absolute authoritarian. He ran the department like an Eastern European dictator. Joe Dominic says Darryl Gates' LAPD, like Parker's, was especially hard on communities of color.
The Los Angeles Police Department was doing stop and frisk long before it was ever labeled stop and frisk.
The stops were abrupt, humiliating, and often done in full view of a spouse or child or neighbors. Each stop added to a deep well of community resentment. When the Rodney King verdict came down, it was on. 2 months later, Darryl Gates was forced to resign. Joe Dominic says L.A. had burned before, Watts in 1965, and now this, unacceptable.
It was bad for the city. It was bad for business. You can't have a city going up in flames twice in 30 years because of their police department.
Gates' LAPD, Dominic says, didn't fit with the power broker's vision of a 21st century metropolis that could draw visitors and businesses from around the world. Jody David Armour teaches and writes about the intersection of race and criminal justice at the University of Southern California's Law School. Armour says the 92 riots were a wake-up call, but the bigger changes happened in 1998 when a huge LAPD scandal made national news.
Try to imagine taking LA Confidential, Serpico, and Training Day, rolling them all into one, and you still don't have the magnitude of the Rampart scandal.
The Rampart Division of the LAPD oversaw one of the most densely populated parts of the city. The residents had been victimized by gangs and violent crime for years. So an elite anti-gang unit was tasked with covertly gathering intelligence on the bad guys. But when it was revealed that several cops at Rampart had actually become bad guys, assaulting suspects and selling confiscated drugs, a civilian commission recommended a consent decree for federal oversight. Jody Armour.
Crime actually fell while the LAPD was under the consent decree, showing that you didn't need a more paramilitary approach to policing, a more zero-tolerance approach to have effective law enforcement that reduced crime.
Ironically, this scandal happened on the watch of Bernard Parks, the city's second black police chief. Lawyer and activist Connie Rice worked with Parks' replacement, New Yorker Bill Bratton, to change police culture. She knew there was too much to lose if things didn't change.
Every single riot in this city was triggered by law enforcement.
Rice's sunny patio is a far cry from the bleak public housing projects where she spent a lot of her time. In her work with both Bratton and the current LAPD chief, Rice says she's found a willingness to engage poor neighborhoods in police-community partnerships. These have kept the peace and built trust with many residents.
They serve the poor community instead of terrorizing and tormenting it and arresting a third of the men in a community, which is what LAPD and the sheriffs did.
That was the old LAPD. Charlie Beck leads the LAPD now. The chief says crime rates today are lower than they were in the 90s, and this gives his people more latitude.
Rather than just chase the symptoms that are crime all day long, we can work on the root causes. And so I think that that's why you see us emphasize trust at a greater rate than our predecessors did.
And here's one more thing Karen told me later about how the LAPD has changed. It looks different. In 1992, at the time of the riots, the sworn force was about 21% Latino and 60% white. Today, it's almost 45% Latino and 30% white. We are at Pico and Alvarado. That's about 6 miles north of where we were. We're with Shereen Marisol Meraji from our Code Switch team. Hey.
Hey.
Tell us why this intersection is important.
So when we talk about the riots, we usually talk about tensions between the African-American community, white law enforcement, and Korean small business owners. I'm going to tell you a story that complicates that narrative a little bit, and it takes place right here in a neighborhood that's predominantly Latino.
Let's hear it.
1223 Alvarado Street. We got flames coming out of the attic, smoke, and people inside the building.
This neighborhood is called Pico Union, and today, Mike Hernandez is reporting a fire. An Our Lady of Guadalupe plaque swings in the breeze from the second floor of a run-down, craftsman-style duplex, its roof in flames. We find out later no one got hurt, but the scene is eerily coincidental. Sirens, a chopper circling, smoke in the air.
It is really weird that we're talking about buildings burning down and there is a building burning down.
Yeah.
Mike Hernandez, the former city councilman who represented this area during the riots, suggested we meet here because all four of these corners were on fire 25 years ago. He says Pico Union hasn't really changed that much since 92. It was, and still is, more than 80% Latino, heavily immigrant, mostly Mexican and Central American, really poor. And Hernandez says back then,
we had the density here twice of Manhattan's. Our fire station, for example, Fire Station 11, was the busiest fire station in the nation.
Hernandez says he knew long before the riots started that Pico Union was just as combustible as South Central LA. The burning and looting spread here on the second day of the unrest, and he recalls that the few law enforcement he saw were not protecting and serving. He says it's because in the early 90s, Latino was often synonymous with illegal. Here he is talking about it on NPR in 1992.
The response to me when I needed the National Guard to protect the people of this area and I needed to protect the businesses, protect the homes, is they gave me the Border Patrol. It was totally an insult.
Today, Hernandez is 65. He has a difficult time catching his breath and uses a giant wooden staff to steady his gait. He says time's dulled his memories, but this is something he can't forget. He told me the rioting triggered nightmares of home for the Central American immigrants who had fled civil war. He doesn't deny people in this community looted, but says the vast majority were scared out of their minds. And fueling that fear, the presence of what was then called the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which included the Border Patrol. Hernandez says he couldn't get anyone to pay attention to what was happening in Pico Union. So he played a little trick on the mayor.
I called Tom Bradley's office. I left a message that said, I heard they were picking up Nigerians in South L.A., INS. About 15, 20 minutes later, I get a call from the mayor.
Hernandez knew Mayor Bradley once lived in South L.A., and some of his most fervent support came from the area's Black community.
And he's like, Councilman, what is this? I hear that INS is picking up Nigerians. And I said, did I see Nigerians? I might have met Nicaraguans. And maybe it wasn't South L.A., maybe it was Pico Union.
And maybe it wasn't just the INS. Maybe it was the LAPD, too.
Wow. This is deja vu.
Madeline Janis is flipping through a stack of declarations from Pico Union residents detained during the riots. Her name came up a bunch of times in Webster Commission documents we found archived in cardboard boxes at the University of Southern California. That was the FBI's five-month investigation into the LAPD's response to the riots. And when I called Janis for an interview, she asked me to bring copies to jog her memory.
Yep, I remember this.
Back then, Janis, an attorney, ran a Pico Union-based nonprofit called Carecen, which is still in the neighborhood and provides all kinds of assistance to immigrants. She told me right after the riots, she helped a couple dozen people facing deportation. People like 18-year-old Salvadoran Marta Campos, arrested by the LAPD at 3 in the afternoon on April 30th while drinking a fruit juice in front of a convenience store. Here's Janis reading from her declaration.
An officer demanded to know my name and if I had any immigration papers and what country I was from. I responded that I had no papers and I told him what country I was from. I was then taken to a police station with many other people. Immigration arrived in several vans and took me and many other people away.
Martha Campos' declaration was taken at an immigration detention center in San Pedro, which is about a 45-minute drive from downtown L.A., 15 days after she was picked up. She says in detention, she slept on narrow concrete benches, was fed dry meat and old bread, and not allowed to bathe. She was 7 months pregnant.
I feared that the treatment I have suffered while in INS custody could have caused or might still cause serious harm to either me or my baby or both. I declare under penalty of perjury that the foregoing is true and correct to the best of my knowledge and belief. Marta Campos. This was so awful, I think I blocked it out of my memory.
What happened to Marta Campos shouldn't have. The LAPD wasn't and still isn't allowed to, quote, initiate police action with the objective of discovering the alien status of a person, unquote. It can only involve immigration enforcement when a, quote, undocumented alien has been arrested for serious misdemeanors or a felony. It's a rule called Special Order 40, and it's been around since the late 70s.
What is Special Order 40? I'm not familiar with it.
That's Robert Mushrack. He was the district director of the INS in Los Angeles during the unrest, and he's been retired for about 23 years. Mushrack remembers the riots were an all-hands-on-deck situation, and he sent in agents to help as requested. End of story. And as far as Special Order 40, here's how he reacted when I told him about it.
I think that's ridiculous. Many people don't realize that illegal entry into the United States is a misdemeanor in and of itself, a violation of 8 U.S.C. 1325, and then a reentry after deportation is a felony. How much longer are we going to accept that in our society?
Current LAPD Chief Charlie Beck seems to have accepted that there are a couple hundred thousand LA residents who don't have legal status.
And, you know, I got to be their police chief, too. I'm not just the police chief to property owners. I'm not just the police chief to business owners.
Chief Beck's been at the LAPD as long as Special Order 40's been around, and he says he can't recall a time it wasn't followed, even after I told him about the Webster Commission documents that show otherwise. Regardless, he says, it's long been crucial that the LAPD isn't thought of as immigration enforcement because it erodes trust and immigrants stop reporting crime. Just last month, LA Mayor Eric Garcetti expanded Special Order 40 to include firefighters, port and airport police. The mayor says he's trying to quell fears stoked in LA's immigrant communities by President Trump's call for more cooperation between local law enforcement and federal immigration authorities.
So to make our city safer, We're focused on keeping those bridges from being burned down right now.
I remind Garcetti, this city burned down 25 years ago, and Special Order 40 appears to have been an afterthought amidst the chaos.
It's one thing to have a policy or a law on the books, but it's another thing to make sure that it is enforced and enforced by everybody. And this new generation of police officers has come up understanding this both from moral and practical terms. We're not perfect, but in this imperfect paradise that we call Los Angeles, I think we're better and more resilient because of what we went through in 1992.
Shireen Marisol Meraji, NPR News.
It wasn't just people's lives that changed during the LA riots. Thousands of buildings and businesses were looted, vandalized, or set on fire. The estimated property damage was over $1 billion. NPR's Sonari Glinton told me about the effort to rebuild the city after the riots. We met at one of those places that was changed during those days.
So Rodeo and Crenshaw is where we are.
Yes. Here is where one of the few grocery stores that served central Los Angeles was located. It burned down in the riots.
And the mayor says, we want the business community to come in and help us rebuild.
That became Rebuild LA.
What happened? I don't see a major grocery store here.
As we look, we don't necessarily see that much investment, but we see plans that were laid down then. We have the metro that's coming in.
Public transportation.
Yeah, but still some of the basic issues, whether or not we have a grocery store in this community and enough of them. You can imagine why all of these problems are difficult to solve, because LA is unusual and the riots are one part of a story that go back at least 100 years.
Let's listen to your story.
Come on, bring it, bring it, bring it. That's right, bring it.
We start on the day, April 29th, 1992. Tom Bradley is one of the nation's first black mayors and one of the most popular of any color. He'd been in office for 20 years. You could say part of Bradley's immense success and political brand was being friendly to business and not scaring the white community. But on this day, his city was in flames. No, actually, not just his city, his neighborhood, his political base. So in the twilight of this historic career, Tom Bradley seemed determined not to let the riots be his legacy. So he reached out for help.
So he called me. I was driving on the Coast Highway here right by the ocean, and I interrupted him by saying, Mayor, I know it's got to be agony, what's going on. He said, just be quiet. I need your help.
Peter Ueberroth was Tom Bradley's go-to guy in the business world. Bradley had tapped Ueberroth to run LA's successful bid for the 1984 Olympics. Those games cemented Tom Bradley's legacy and made Ueberroth a very, very rich man. So when the mayor called, Ueberroth gave him the typical, whatever you need, Mr. Mayor, you have my full support, sir. Oh, you need help? I can be there first thing tomorrow morning.
And he said, no, I have a better idea. Our helicopter has you in its sight. And so I pulled off the side of the road, and the helicopter landed on the Coast Highway here, and all the cars stopped in both directions, and dust went all everywhere. I got on the helicopter, and it took me in a route where they weren't shooting at the helicopters, where they could get back in, and I met with them that first day.
That first day, that first phone call, was the origin of what would be called Rebuild LA. Think the Marshall Plan for downtown Los Angeles and South Central, though instead of the U.S. giving money to rebuild Europe, private business money would be directed to the rebuild efforts. And Bradley gave a very basic instruction on that day.
He said, I'd like private sector people coming in here and trying to solve problems and raise some money, do something, make it happen.
Make it happen. That was Ueberroth's charge. Break down the barriers and red tape to get money and investment into the community. And as the riots abated and the National Guard left, many in the community looked to Rebuild LA as, well, maybe the economic cavalry is coming. So if we get into the NPR Wayback Machine and set the dial for 1992, you can hear the hopefulness in the community's response.
We have to begin to think beyond the end of this incident and what we can do to rebuild.
Father! Take these hands and help us build a new city.
5 to 10 years from now, this place is going to be so nice. All this down here is going to be black-owned business. She's going to have a nail shop. She's going to have a beauty shop. It's going to be our turn. It's our turn now.
If you start to transfer the ownership of the community to the community, everybody will prosper.
Expectations were high, says John Mack, who was the head of the Urban League during the riots and eventually a part of Rebuild LA.
Once I got over my anger behind the King beating, you know, I was beginning to feel cautiously optimistic that maybe we can get some things done.
Mack joined in the hope that his long list of economic issues, in addition to police reform, would be tackled. Lack of retail, jobs, affordable housing, investment in transportation. These had been problems in South Central since at least before silent movies and the oil boom that put L.A. on the map. Rebuild L.A. was supposed to act as a funnel for money, talent, and expertise into the inner city. The organization directed private money to the burned-out neighborhoods, building on the model of the 1984 Olympics. Though that was a bit of magical thinking. John Mack says the leaders of Rebuild L.A. were well-intentioned, but naive.
I said, Peter, this is not the Olympics. You're not going to have everybody coming rallying around the flag. You know, it's not going to be that easy. You got a different kind of challenge here.
There were problems from the very beginning. After a race riot, the leaders of this economic cavalry were essentially rich white men. Ubroth lived in Newport Beach in Orange County, 40 minutes and a universe away from South Central. There were months of fighting about who'd be on the board, and when the news media lost interest, Mack says so did many in the business community.
And some promises were made. You know, press conferences were held. The Vaughn Supermarket leadership at the time made a pledge they were going to build 10 or 12 supermarkets strategically throughout the community. One was built.
Eventually, Rebuild LA fizzled and was disbanded. Many think that makes it a failure, but it did have an influence.
So I think the LA riots were one of those traumatic events like Hurricane Katrina was in New Orleans or the bankruptcy was in Detroit that essentially reconfigured how a neighborhood could be seen by those with power and money.
Peter Moskovitz is the author of How to Kill a City, Gentrification, Inequality, and the Fight for the Neighborhood. He says out of the destruction of the riots came economic opportunity for some in the business world. Mayor Bradley's response created, though, a template.
So after the LA riots, there was a lot of vacant storefronts. There was a lot of property damage. There was a lot of fear about the inner city. And that essentially allowed property developers to snap up properties for cheap.
John Mack, formerly of the Urban League, says many of the problems Rebuild LA was trying to address are 100-year-old, 200-year-old problems that he says take more than just goodwill from business leaders.
You have to be there for the long haul. And let's face it, the opposition, you can't let folk outwork you because you know folk who don't want to do the right thing are on duty all the time.
John Mack says Los Angeles didn't get a whole lot from Rebuild LA, but he says the silver lining is that other cities learn from the experience, hopefully. Sonari Lenton, NPR News.
When you talk about the unrest that broke out here in LA 25 years ago after the Rodney King verdict, one thing people usually remember is the looting.
What's in here? Elgin Gold Watch.
You're driving around with a police scanner, just checking out where things are?
Yeah. We're not necessarily trying to steal, because I'm going to tell you the truth. I didn't loot it. I looted. I'm not going to lie. I didn't took a lot.
People went into grocery stores, liquor stores, clothing stores, electronic stores, and just walked out with stuff. A few years ago, I met a guy who told me that he had been a looter back then. His name is Gilbert Monterosa. And back in 1992, he was in junior high. He was living in South Central with his two sisters and his mom, who had immigrated from El Salvador. And he says what happened during the LA riots kind of changed his life. Here's what he was like at the time.
It was known across my neighborhood that I was a mama's boy, that I listened to everything she had to say. And because my dad wasn't around, and my stepdad wasn't also around, I had to play the machismo card and show them that I was the man.
Gilbert's mom worked long days at a garment factory.
She woke up every day at 4:30 in the morning, got our lunches ready, dropped off my siblings next door, and I had to wait until about 7 or so to go to school. I would walk myself to school.
That's what happened the morning of April 30th. The riots had actually started the night before, but because Gilbert's mom didn't let the kids watch TV at night, they had no idea. So Gilbert starts walking to school, finds out school's been canceled. He goes back home and turns on the TV.
KTLA, Channel 5, Los Angeles.
And sees his neighborhood on fire and a lot of people looting.
Screen, you'll see there's people carrying away boxes.
I swear I sat there watching that 13-inch black and white television for about maybe 4 hours.
Then a couple of Gilbert's friends from school come over and try to convince him to go looting too. They go to Gilbert's neighbor's house to ask if they can use his pickup truck. And at first, Gilbert does not want to go looting. But then the neighbor, Eduardo, says something that changes his mind.
Eduardo, I remember, said, "And this little bitch is going?" It just burned me up inside. And I said to him, "Yeah, I'm going."
So they get in the truck and head to the Fedco. It's kind of like the Costco at the time. And it is pretty insane.
It was as if somebody had opened up the doors to Fedco and they were just giving stuff away. People that I knew that were in opposing gangs were helping each other out. And there's stuff everywhere on the floor. Clothing, food, everything is just chaos. Absolute chaos.
Gilbert's friends go inside. They tell him to guard the truck. Gilbert is still pretty nervous. But then he starts thinking, maybe there is one thing he might actually want to steal. I mean, something his mom could never afford. A boombox. Because Gilbert is really into music.
I want a girl with extensions in her hair, bamboo earrings, at least 2 pair.
LL Cool J, Ice Cube, N.W.A. A lot of R&B, a lot of hip-hop. That was my life. Because that's all you listened to growing up in South Central.
It was pretty good. Like, that was a good time for music.
The early 90s were great.
So Gilbert goes inside the Fedco and grabs a boombox. And remember, there's stuff all over the floor.
I looked down on the floor and there was this album cover with a baby swimming and a dollar bill on a hook. And I saw that and I said, what the f*** is that? What is that, right?
And what it was Nevermind by Nirvana. Gilbert picks it up and gets back home before his mom does. He sneaks the boombox and the CD in the house. He waits for her to go to bed, puts on headphones, hits play. And here's Nirvana for the first time.
And it was unreal. It was like opening an entire world of music to me. It was sonically aggressive, yet sublime at the same time. There was these like breaks in the music where everything was just really hard and then it just came down and built up again. And in my mind's eye, I could picture the riots as I was listening to Smells Like Teen Spirit. And it just became the soundtrack of that day.
That CD made Gilbert start thinking differently about stuff. Getting into Nirvana got him into a bunch of other music.
It led me back to The Clash. And The Clash led me back to The Stones. And The Stones led me back to The Beatles. And then I listened to Bohemian Rhapsody. And then from there, I went on to La Traviata.
It was right around this time that Gilbert's mom decided to move to a new neighborhood, and Gilbert went to a new school. Because he was into grunge, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, flannel shirts, he started hanging out with the other grunge dudes, dudes who were into editing videos and doing graphic design.
These guys were like friends with the jocks, the cheerleaders, the burnouts, the cholos. I talked to everybody because I was part of that group of guys that listened to alternative music.
Gilbert says if he hadn't changed his music and his clothes at the same time he changed his neighborhood, he probably would have ended up getting in trouble, like his other friends back in the old neighborhood.
If I would have stayed in South Central, I know for a fact that I would either be dead or in jail. Because My ego wouldn't have allowed me to be a punk. Just like I was taught to go into the LA riots by Eduardo, these guys were able to push my buttons. And if you have that much machismo growing inside of you and you come from a broken home where you have to be the man, I probably would have been part of this group of guys that would have ended up getting arrested or killed by another gang of people.
It wasn't all easy in the new school. Gilbert eventually dropped out, but then he got his GED. Now he works in IT for a security company that allows you to monitor your home through your smartphone. He's got a wife and a little boy. His mom's retired, and he and his sisters take care of her. 25 years ago, Gilbert Monterosa stole some stuff during the LA riots. He did a bad thing that day, but in this way, it turned out to be a good thing. Driving around LA, he says he still thinks about how one album changed his life.
That's so crazy. You don't still like have that CD? I mean, nobody saves
CDs. I have that CD. I still listen to that album. And instead of seeing a FETCO on La Cienega and Rodeo, I see a Target there now, you know? And I'm listening to this and I go, man, that's where I heard you for the first time. It's like a really bad relationship, yet a really good relationship you can't forget about.
The Target does not smell like Teen Spirit.
No, it does not. That's good.
Thanks for listening. This series was produced by Anjali Sastry and edited by Melissa Gray with help from National Desk intern Parker Yesko. It was adapted for NPR One by Viet Le. Special thanks to Karen Grigsby Bates and Shireen Marisol Meraji from our Code Switch team and Sonari Glinton from our business desk. For more on the legacy of the Los Angeles riots, visit npr.org/LA riots.